Live from Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Hundreds of thousands of babies are born in California each year, roughly 420,000, and that's the latest count from the state, which is back in 2021. But the pregnancy journey can vary drastically from one parent to the next. Although there have been huge strides in maternal health over the decades, the United States has the highest maternal death rate when compared to other developed high-income countries, and that trickles down to California. By far, Black women account for the majority of deaths during or in the immediate aftermath of pregnancy. In California, the death rate for Black birthing people is more than three times higher than others. In response, state lawmakers passed a law requiring hospitals to conduct unconscious bias training. That was back in 2019. And in the nearly 4 years since the law took effect, less than one in five hospitals in California have complied. CalMatters healthcare reporter Kristen Wong joins us with more about the findings, as well as California's maternal mortality rate as it is ticking upward. Kristen, thanks for making the time.
Of course, always great to be here.
So CalMatters is investigating maternal care in the state. How did this come about?
Really just taking a look at the, you know, long-term upward trend of maternal mortality and severe maternal outcomes is really quite stunning. So it was something that myself and my colleagues wanted to dig into. Since 2012, California's maternal mortality rate has been steadily creeping upward. And, you know, given that the state is really looked at as a model for the rest of the country for improving maternal outcomes, you know, it seems like something that is quite stunning, really.
Yeah, I mean, that's about a decade of an upward trend in the wrong direction. And then in your reporting, you also say that according to the state, that more than half of these pregnancy-related deaths are preventable. When I read that, that's just a striking finding. What are you learning that helps explain why they're not being prevented?
It's a really complicated issue. Some of it has to do with, you know, population changes. Women are tending to have kids later. And our underlying population health is also getting, you know, worse, or we have sort of like pre-existing conditions that lend themselves to things, you know, things like hypertension, diabetes also lend themselves to poor outcomes during birth. But really, you know, these disparities become especially stark and make it more clear that it's about, you know, quality healthcare access when you start to look at, you know, what kinds of insurance people have and at the racial and ethnic disparities. Like you mentioned, Black women have more than three times the death rate of anyone else. And that spans all income levels and all education levels. And so really there's something else going on there.
Yeah, and this report, your recent reporting, it comes on the heels of a new investigation by the California Department of Justice, the Attorney General's office. Why was this launched?
So in 2020, a law took effect requiring any facility that does, you know, maternal health care to train their employees on implicit bias. There's a ton of research about how racism makes its way into healthcare and how that impacts outcomes. And the Attorney General, the Department of Justice, you know, took a look at this to see what facilities were actually complying. They assessed hospitals specifically, although the law also applies to primary care, people who do prenatal care. And the findings were really quite you know, quite extraordinary in a bad way. Very few hospitals, as you mentioned, were in compliance. And the report also notes that it was not until the Department of Justice asked the hospitals about their training status that more than a third of them began training.
And this, you know, law that requires compliance, it came from state lawmakers back in 2019. I believe it's called like the California Dignity in Pregnancy and Childbirth Act. You know, can you remind us what the intention of that law is?
Of course. So this law, I mean, it really was one of the first in a series of recent steps to try and address this vast disparity among poor maternal outcomes with among Black women and birthing people. So this law, it required all maternal healthcare staff to take training on implicit bias and systemic racism in healthcare, and also on, you know, sort of what these poor outcomes tend to look like.
When it comes to structural racism within the medical field, what does that look like? You know, when you actually talk to people to better understand why this law was even needed in the first place.
There's a lot of research about racism in healthcare settings. I think actually that Attorney General Rob Bonta, when he was, you know, talking about the results of this investigation, he actually gave a very personal example about his wife, also a lawmaker, Mia Bonta, that, you know, she was in a lot of pain during pregnancy. They went to the hospital and she was accused of, you know, seeking drugs improperly, and the staff treated her poorly and did not believe her. And I think that's a really, you know, it's well documented that that's a very common experience for Black women who are pregnant.
Yeah, I mean, even, you know, in the entertainment industry or in pop culture, you have Beyonce and Serena Williams. They both have, you know, shared their experiences about having negative or even life-threatening experiences during childbirth. So this also even spans, you know, income as well. It's not just race or ethnicity when we're talking about this. So when this law came about, it was to prevent or to train to prevent implicit bias. Can you help us visualize what this implicit bias training, you know, what it looks like or what it should look like?
Well, as one lawmaker assembly member, Akilah Weber, said, it is the quote unquote bare minimum of what health professionals can do to improve these outcomes. So there are a number of approved sort of training programs that hospitals and other facilities can use, but it's really to sort of debunk these, you know, false myths about how, you know, Black people differ physiologically from everybody else. I think there was a survey in 2016 that found about half of white medical students believed that there were biological differences between Black patients and everyone else. And that really led them to dismiss patient concerns and make inaccurate treatment decisions. And so the training is really aimed at sort of deconstructing those myths.
Given that, you know, we know that maternal death rates are known to disproportionately impact Black women and birthing people, and this is the driving force behind that law, and now we're learning after an investigation, you know, hospitals, the vast majority are not complying with this law. Can you give us a better picture of how bad those disparities are in California?
Of course. So Black women are more than three times more likely than any other racial and ethnic group to die during pregnancy. They also have the highest rates of severe maternal morbidity or poor outcomes like hemorrhage or sepsis. And among infants as well, Black infants are three times more likely than white infants to die, either during childbirth or immediately after. And the next highest group is Pacific Islanders, and they are still 1.5 times higher, more likely to die.
And it's important to note that when it comes to Black birthing people, they're just a sliver of California pregnancies, like 5%, yet they make up, you know, the majority of pregnancy-related deaths in the state.
Yeah, the disparities are very, very stark.
So when it comes to this investigation, which was just released this month, you know, how did you better understand why so few hospitals are in compliance with this law?
You know, one of the things that lawmakers and the Attorney General brought up is that the law really didn't have any teeth built into it. You know, the law took effect in 2020, and theoretically everybody should have been preparing to be in compliance, but there were no specific deadlines or penalties for non-compliance. And there's also not a state agency that is directed to enforce the law. So if the Department of Justice had not independently decided to assess whether hospitals and other facilities were in compliance, we still would have no idea. And probably, you know, based on their findings, that many of these facilities didn't even start training until they got a Department of Justice inquiry, which I'm sure is probably alarming. you know, there would probably still be a very, very low proportion of hospitals that had even begun training. Actually, I think it's worth noting that when they started, not a single employee in the state was trained.
Not a single employee in the state. And that was before it became law, correct?
No. This was when the Attorney General started the investigation more than a year and a half after the law took effect.
Wow. Okay. So then what did the Attorney General, Attorney General Bonta have to say about this? I mean, he's also a former lawmaker.
He is. I mean, he really encouraged lawmakers to, amend the law, improve it, the law is the first draft, to strengthen and add some more regulations into this.
As it stands today, then, do you have an idea of how many hospitals have complied with this law, a percentage within the state?
So the investigation ended last summer, and at that point, about 3/4 of hospitals had started the training. Among those hospitals, a majority of the employees, around 80%, were fully trained, but they were still not 100% trained. And that's sort of the most recent data point that we have.
Yeah, and there's still a ways to go, clearly. I mean, when it comes to the lawmakers who are currently state lawmakers, did they have any response to these findings?
They did. I mean, I think that Assemblymember Akilah Weber, who is herself a physician and specifically an obstetrician, said that she pledged to really take a look at this and follow up on this issue in the upcoming legislative session.
What about hospitals? What do they have to say? I mean, is it a bandwidth issue? I mean, did you get a better understanding of why this hasn't happened?
There hasn't been an official sort of response from the hospital association. I know one of the things that was discussed was, the impact of COVID, as we all know, that really disrupted everything in the healthcare system and hospitals in particular. But, as I mentioned, Assemblymember Akilah Weber is a physician and she was still, seeing patients at the time. And so she and other lawmakers really brought up the point that even though hospitals, were dealing with something unprecedented in the early days of the pandemic, there was still room for residents and physician training and for, this kind of continued education to happen, and that it's really a matter of priorities. And it's clear that hospitals were not prioritizing this training and this law.
Well, and also the pandemic brought out disparities within healthcare, because of COVID-19. And then also during that time, when you look at data from the state, I mean, pregnancy-related deaths also jumped significantly, in 2021 because, related to, it's during the same time as COVID-19 and the pandemic. Finally, Kristen, when it comes to what this law could look like with teeth, did you get a better idea of what that could look like following this investigation?
There was sort of, as I mentioned earlier, some talk about, adding penalties, having at least one, if not more, state agencies in charge of enforcing the law, of assessing regularly. Like I mentioned, the Attorney General's investigation concluded last summer. So it's been more than a year since we have any idea like how many hospitals are in compliance, and kind of, making that information public, I think, often goes a really long way in terms of compliance.
Is there other legislation currently on the table that the state has passed that's trying to curb this issue, maternal deaths?
A couple of years ago, lawmakers passed what is known as the Momnibus Act, and that was also a package of bills aimed at improving this great disparity in these poor maternal outcomes among Black women. And that included a lot of things like Medi-Cal reimbursement for doulas. It also had Medi-Cal cover pregnant people up to a year post-birth, which is actually the time period in which most women die. And so there have been a lot of recent efforts to try and, turn these numbers around.
And this is my finally, I know I already said finally, but this is my last question. Where's your reporting taking you next on this issue?
We are reporting across the state, Imperial County, the far northern counties. There have been, it's a national trend that maternity wards are closing across the country. California is certainly not immune to that trend. And that really poses an access problem, which is something that has come up in LA County as well. The communities that are impacted by these closures and by the staff leaving the area subsequently tend to be communities that are already, face disproportionate impacts in terms of access to other kinds of healthcare.
Kristen, thank you so much.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
That is CalMatters healthcare reporter Kristen Wong talking about an investigation from the California Attorney General's office, which found that the vast majority of hospitals are not complying with unconscious bias training when it comes to maternal health care. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicky Gonzalez. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. 5 years ago, a grassroots community-engaged research center was established at UC Davis, the Belosan Center for Filipino Studies. Since 2018, the center has worked to record and elevate the experiences of the Filipino diaspora and create an academic space for the field of Filipino studies. Now, the center is marking the beginning of a new era, independent of the university, but still focused on highlighting the history and the stories of this Asian community. Here to talk more about the center's past, present, and future is Dr. Robin Rodriguez. She is Professor Emeritus of Asian American Studies at UC Davis and the founder of the Belosan Center, as well as its new umbrella organization, the Amado Kaya Initiative, named after her late son. Welcome to Insight, Dr. Rodriguez.
Thank you so much for having me, Vicky.
You know, this was such a groundbreaking institution back in 2018. You are the founder of this. Can you give us the backstory of what led to the creation of the Belosan Center at UC Davis?
Sure. You know, your previous guest was really talking about systemic racism in healthcare. Well, really, we continue to deal with systemic racism in terms of investment in research on communities of color. So the story for the Belosan Center really goes back, I think, to when I first started at UC Davis and 2011. I was actually hired specifically for my expertise in Filipino studies, and it was exciting because I was actually brought in with another faculty member, a Dr. Sarita C., who also does this work in Filipino studies. And so we already thought this is a wonderful opportunity to come together and create a space to really develop Filipino studies. Had approached the dean at the time. The dean sort of rejected our proposal for the creation of some sort of a center. And really, after that time, I tried again and again to apply for funding for different research projects. All of my research has really in the main been focused on the Filipino community, often rejected. This is a common experience for many Filipino scholars. And by 2018, I had just gotten a full professorship. So that's really the highest rank you can achieve in the professoriate. And yet I still had students coming to me from other departments on campus, from outside of Davis, really struggling in their doctoral programs with very little support, faculty members dissuading them from studying the Filipino experience. And I thought, you know, I need to leverage my new status as full professor, and I was also chair at the time of Asian American Studies. My deep roots in the community as a community organizer, engaged scholar, and just really tap into just a culture of philanthropy. And a culture of really coming together to create institutions. So, you know, we have so many examples in the Filipino-American community where the Filipino community has come together to, whether it's been to purchase buildings. You know, there's been a history of Filipinos early on in our history. And mind you, we've been in this country for over a century. Mm-hmm. And so the early migrants who were low-wage workers still found a way to come together and purchase a building. In the 1960s, Filipino community members came together to build what was called is still called the Agbayani Village, a retirement home for now older Filipino migrant workers. And so I thought, you know what? We do this. We know how to do this. Let's just try.
Yeah, I mean, you make it sound with the hindsight, so simple. But what I hear from you is you had to fight and fight and fight to make this a reality, or even just fight to make Filipino studies relevant. You know, when you look back on that time over the years, were there a theme of like main arguments you would get from people in higher positions of academia, you know, who would kind of dissuade, you know, pursuing this?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the response is, who cares? Who cares about Filipino Americans? I remember being in a text exchange with my late colleague and beloved friend, Dr. Don Mabalan, who really put a lot of attention on Larry Itliong, the labor leader who now people have some familiarity with. His birthday was just last week.
Yeah, it was just Larry Itliong Day, October 25th.
That's right. And Dr. Mabalan was one of the really key movers and shakers to put that new kind of spotlight on Larry. And I remember we were in a text exchange and she sent me a screenshot of a response to a grant application for the book that she ended up publishing. And basically, it was like, we're not going to fund this because who's going to read a book about Larry Itliong? And that's sort of the example. And, you know, there was actually research that came out not too long ago. I think it was published in Scientific American just about the lack of investment generally in Asian American research. I mean, I really think that has to do with the ways that Asian Americans, there's a kind of model minority myth attached to Asian Americans. They're all successful. They're all doing great. Why are we going to really look
at their... And a monolith, right?
Right, and a monolith. Why are we going to invest in research dollars in them? But really, when you disaggregate our community, you see that our experiences are so distinctive. But that's not something that major institutions that fund research understand. I think that's shifted a little bit. And so we had to fight tooth and nail and have to really kind of be very imaginative about how we were going to create a space at this institution.
And talking about history that might be overlooked or neglected, it's an important reminder, maybe even a first for people to know. I mean, this year marks 125 years since the Philippine-American War. I mean, that started before 1900 in 1898. Can you remind us what happened then and also how that really characterized the Filipino-American relationship across history in that time?
Sure. 1898 really marked the United States emerging as a global empire. You know, the United States is very much organized early on, you know, and arguably it can be said even today by this manifest destiny, right? That was sort of the thinking that justified settler colonialism in the continent and then eventually colonialism overseas. And so 1898, you know, we're typically taught that it was the moment of the Spanish-American War that was ended by the Treaty of Paris. But we don't get taught is that the Filipinos had been fighting in an anti-colonial struggle against the Spanish and won, had declared their independence. We celebrated as a community every June 12th. And in effect, the United States and the Spanish kind of brokered a deal. The Spanish didn't want to have to declare defeat to its colonial subjects
and honor the independence.
Right. They instead conceded to defeat to the United States and sold the Philippines to the United States for $20 million in the Treaty of Paris. And so that whole history is generally obscured, still obscured. You might be lucky if you get more than a sentence that talks about the Philippines, and certainly no real account of the Philippine-American War. But the reality is Filipinos fought their previous colonizer and fought again against the Americans, who they felt betrayed them, because there was this sense that America, having its own anti-colonial history, was going to come in and be an ally. And they soon, what Filipinos thought would be an ally turned their guns against the Filipino people themselves.
And am I corrected? Did the Philippines end up gaining their independence? It doesn't seem like that long ago, like in 1946. It was after World War II.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, you know, that's something that people will debate. But certainly, I think there's a general consensus in Filipino studies among Filipino scholars that 1946 did not mark a genuine independence. It really marked what many of us think of as a moment of neocolonial dependence that has continued to be sustained between the United States and the Philippines. And that, you know, was already codified in the Philippine Constitution that really granted or really preserved a lot of U.S. economic, political, and military interests in the Philippines. And that's really continued in so many ways, you know, over the decades since 1946. You know, many people know of the late dictator, Ferdinand Ferdinand Marcos, that he was an ally to the United States, despite, you know, thousands and thousands of people rallying in the streets, despite clear evidence of human rights violations. The U.S. continued to support the Marcos regime. And even since then, human rights violations by successive Philippine presidents, oftentimes the U.S. government has turned a very blind eye. And we worry about the state of the Philippines, especially now that the late dictator's son is president.
And I bring that up because here in California, specifically in our area, we have a large Filipino community. I mean, Filipinos are either the largest or second largest AAPI community in many counties in our region, Sacramento County, Placer County, San Joaquin County, Yolo County as well. So, you know, there are deep ties here. You know, if you can share a little bit about the local history that Filipinos and Filipino Americans have made here in this portion of Northern California.
Yeah, well, you know, of course, because Sacramento is, you know, the farm to fort capital. But, you know, that what that means then is that we've always, this region has always been really crucial, a site for agricultural production, right? And because of that, it was the first landing place, really, for early Filipino migrants who were really brought in during the colonial period as laborers for farms all across the state of California. Now, in Sacramento, I mean, the Filipino community has been here for nearly a century. At least our institutions even are still around. You have the Filipino community of Sacramento and vicinity, the FCSV, that will be celebrating, I believe, its 100th year in 1929. Although even with them, they've been fighting and struggling to be able to build a community center. You know, the community members have been slowly but surely raising money to be able to finally create a center to mark, a century of presence, but also to be a space for generations in the future as Filipinos continue to migrate directly from the Philippines to Sacramento. People are migrating from the Bay Area into Sacramento. So I'm a Bay Area transplant. So there are all of these wonderful institutions that Filipinos have created and built in this community. And yet a lot of those things, there hasn't been a lot of attention to them. People don't even realize that kind of trace that Filipinos have on the region.
Yeah, especially when talking about the migrant community. I mean, for decades and many, many decades, we know of Cesar Chavez, Dolores Huerta, but then there's also Larry Itliong, which has been getting more awareness in recent years, and I think some would argue overdue. Yeah. Awareness to the contributions to the Central Valley and the migrant community. That also brings me to your center, the Belosan Center. You know, can you talk to us about the namesake, why you named it the Belosan Center?
Yeah, you know, Carlos Belosan was a writer and also a labor organizer predating Larry Itliong and others. He was writing in the 1940s. He wrote a very critical novel, America's in the Heart, semi-autobiographical novel that really detailed the experiences of Filipino migrants in the early decades of the 20th century. And, you know, in many ways, he himself was forgotten, died quite young in his late 40s, very impoverished, in spite of some, you know, success with his writing, still, you know, experienced racism in so many ways. Was really, I think, rediscovered in the 1960s with the fight for ethnic studies and the establishment of Asian American studies. So he was brought to new attention. And, you know, I encountered him for the first time in an ethnic studies course as an undergrad. He was so deeply impactful on me personally. I remember wanting to bite a book from my brother. I was like, can you imagine this has been happening in this state? We had no idea. And, you know, that led me on my own journey. And so I wanted the center to be named after Carlos Belosan to really center our commitment as a community-engaged center. Carlos Belosan didn't just write to write. He wrote for the purpose of amplifying our community's issues and problems and really using that platform to also advocate for the Filipino community. So I wanted to be able to capture that by naming the center after such, you know, an important historical figure.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio, and if you're just joining us, we're speaking with Dr. Robin Rodriguez, founder of the UC Davis Belosan Center for Filipino Studies, which is now becoming part of the Amado Kaya Initiative. So let's get to this new chapter. What led to this new chapter for the Belosan Center being incorporated into the Amado Kaya Initiative, which is named after your son?
Yeah, sure. I mean, you know, I think as soon as we were able to secure some major investment, also through advocacy efforts. So first we got all sorts of funding from the community. Then the community mobilized and got a state allocation. And that was fantastic, being able to have all of this money now to run all of our research and education programs. But almost immediately, I could already feel just the ways that the university wasn't going to support us. And so, you know, by 2020 already, a couple of years in, I was already feeling that we were going to have to make an exit plan, because there was really not going to come, no support was going to come from the university. And during the pandemic, I think there was just a sense. And, you know, mind you, I think UC Davis and the UC campuses as a whole have not been the most ideal place for lots of people. You know, of course, there have been numerous labor struggles on the campus. And I think a lot of us were just feeling like this is not an institution that really cares for its workers. Certainly, you know, didn't feel like it was cared for its students, didn't care for the kinds of research that matters to Californians, really. And so I was already feeling this in 2020. And frankly, you know, I lost my son in 2020 as well. He had decided to live in the Philippines to live and learn from indigenous communities. And I think that tragedy, along with all of the things that had already been happening in the institution, you know, it made me pause, made me think, you know what, maybe there's a different way. And, you know, it was an invitation, I think, for me to really explore alternative possibilities. So, you know, I decided I was going to retire early. I think I was sort of part of that great, I mean, there were so many people, I think, during the pandemic realized we could remake our worlds. I did too. And, you know, of course, I thought, Amado Kaya, what a wonderful a way to honor my son, to have his work live on. He was such a he was so committed to Filipino studies, to ethnic studies himself. Really, really loved documenting, actually, histories of the leadership and contribution of Filipino labor leaders like Larry Itliong and Philip Veracruz. That was actually work he did before he left for the Philippines. So I thought, you know, if we're going to take this institution, the Belosan Center, out of the UC system, it makes perfect sense mm-hmm. to be under a new namesake. You know,
a new century,
right? I think a Filipino American who represents, yes, the 21st century Filipino. He was biracial. He was hearing impaired. I think that just his identity, his commitments really represent a kind of the Filipino American experience of today. And so, you know, it's been really exciting. We're already, you know, I mean, the transition has been sort of quick, but it's and so we already have a new fellowship launched. We have this wonderful fellowship for young folks interested in being digital media producers. We have another one that will have people going into the Central Valley to continue to document Filipinos' contributions to the Valley, whether they were farm workers or, you know, our healthcare workers. So, you know, we're really excited that we're seeing many of these programs continue on.
Just in about a month or so of it being incorporated, but you've already built so much momentum, mm-hmm. you know, for the years and the decades to come. You know, finally, you mentioned that you retired and you're professor emeritus from UC Davis, but you also started a nonprofit farm. And I want to talk to you about that, you know, before we let you go for our conversation.
Yeah. There were so many
things. Reimagination Farm.
Yeah, Reimagination Farm. You know, COVID, I think, so many transitions, marked so many transitions for, I guess, all of us, certainly for the family. You know, among the things that was going through my mind, along with, I got to get out of this university. We need to start to do something new. Part of the new that we wanted to do as a family was to really reconnect differently with the land. I think for us as a family, the COVID wasn't just about, you know, some virus. For us, I think we felt like it was symptomatic about the ways that we as humanity are not in right relation to the land. And so I think as partly as a way of continuing to honor what Amado did. I mean, he was learning from indigenous communities who were at the forefront of fighting against climate change, and really trying to center indigenous knowledges of the land, because climate change is very much about, again, this relationship we have of extraction to the land. And so we just felt that, you know, we needed to kind of do that as well as a lifestyle shift. So lots of changes in our family, learning to farm for the very, very first time. We've had a bountiful first harvest. And I suppose we have had also a bountiful harvest in the new initiative of, you know, replanting, so to speak, the Bluzon Center into Amado Kaya.
Yeah, and touching so many other lives.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Dr. Rodriguez. It was wonderful speaking with you.
Well, thank you so much for having me this morning.
Dr. Robin Rodriguez is the founder of the UC Davis Bluzon Center for Filipino Studies, as well as its new incarnation as part of the Amado Kaya Initiative. Still ahead, the Broadway International Food Festival makes its return this weekend, bringing vibrant food, arts, music, and so much more to Sacramento. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment. Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Sacramento has long been known as one of the most diverse cities in the country, and there are few places that reflect that diversity better than the Broadway corridor. That's where you can sample a wealth of cuisines from around the world in just the span of a few blocks. Eclectic shops and boutiques, the choices are endless. The city of Sacramento is reinvesting in the area. The Complete Streets Project is making it more convenient and safer to visit Broadway. In late August, the city broke ground on a $14 million improvement project, which includes better lighting, bigger sidewalks, and traffic calming measures. So if you haven't taken a stroll along Broadway recently, this weekend would be perfect to get reacquainted with the corridor through its food, its culture, and its music. Zion Tedesa owns Queen Sheba Ethiopian Restaurant along Broadway and is one of the lead organizers of the Broadway International Festival, which is happening on Saturday. Zion, welcome. Nice seeing you as always.
Yeah, thank you for having me, Nikki.
Yeah. Okay, so it is one love, one community, one heart. I love how you capture this festival. Can you just explain those words, what they mean to you as someone who has long owned a business on Broadway and as an organizer of the festival?
Yes, so I am very fortunate to be able to really do this Broadway International Festival that really brings Sacramento and the surrounding community together through music, through food. As you know, Broadway is a place where the whole world of food is there. Like, we have Ethiopian food, Mexican food, Indian food, Asian food, Japanese food. So why not bring the community together to celebrate through food and music, entertainment, and also health and wellness.
What led to creating this festival?
So, you know, we've been talking about it for a long time, especially the businesses on Broadway, even though Broadway is, you know, a street, a very known street. But in Sacramento, Broadway is not really, you know, having what we have, we're not really presenting it as we're supposed to. So we've been talking about doing something about it. So with the business around, we came together to say, like, why don't we bring the city officials, the community, and the businesses together to really celebrate Broadway, who we are, what we present, especially when we present foods from around the world.
Yeah, I know. I love walking down Broadway. There's,
yes.
You'd be hard-pressed to leave hungry.
Yes, that's for sure,
and your restaurant included. We're going to get to the food, because obviously there's going to be, you know, so much good food at the festival, but there's also a health and a wellness aspect
yes.
to the the festival. What can people expect when they go on Saturday?
So, you know, for me, I'm all about our health and wellness, especially our holistic health, our spiritual health, our mental health, our physical health, of course, our financial health, too. So, the health that was especially coming through COVID, we weren't able to do it for 2 years because of COVID happened. And then we were able to open up the Broadway, you know, last year and the year before. So this is like bringing people together for who we are as human beings, like culture, music, food, you know, food is your medicine. So those are the kind of thing really at my heart, you know, when it comes to health and wellness of community, especially we live here in Sacramento. So that's what we're trying to really bring the health and wellness community as well, so we can teach each other from each other, yeah. Learn from each other, from one another.
Yeah, it's easy to take for granted how diverse the cuisines are along the Broadway corridor. You know, I mean, you yes. laid out, you know, food from so many different countries, you know, yours included, and you've had your restaurant along Broadway for many years. What do you think it is about the Broadway corridor that attracts so many different cuisines from all over the world?
Yeah, because, you know, as you know, Broadway has even a historical place. You know, it has a lot of history even before. So Broadway is even in the whole United States, it has that special, it's a special street that always something functional happening, art, music, theater, and everything else that happens, who we are as people. So that it represents that. So, but we don't really celebrate that here. So why not celebrate our differences, our culture, our food, and we're on Broadway.
Of course. How yeah. fitting. And also, like this festival that you helped found, you're a couple years in, and I can only imagine taking it in year after year is just so special, celebrating, you know, a big piece of your life and other people's lives as well. For small
yeah,
businesses.
Absolutely. As you know, after COVID, we had inflation, and now Broadway, they've tried to fix the whole Broadway, too, street. So it affects businesses at the end of the day, and also the homelessness. There's so much going on Broadway that really affects small businesses like mine. So this is a way of, like, really promoting who we are as a business, small businesses, entrepreneurs, and nonprofits coming together and bringing the community to say, look, we are here, support mm-hmm. us. We're small businesses. Put your money where your mouth is. So in that way, most of small businesses can survive also.
I mean, we've been checking in with you over yeah. the years. I mean, I've talked to you, interviewed you many times, even before the pandemic, but certainly through yes. the pandemic. Can you give us a sense of how the Broadway corridor, how it's doing today compared to, you know, when we checked in with you like 3 years ago?
Yeah. I mean, for me, you know, it's a matter of pushing through every day, you know. Things happen like every day, especially when you are in business, is getting mentally ready to be able to handle and navigate through those things. It's a survival. At the same time, you know, when you're doing what you love doing, it's, you know, everybody asks me, oh, how you, this is so hard. But when you're doing what you love to do, then it's not as hard as, you know, most people think. So, I mean, on Broadway, like I was saying, we have a lot of problem, but it's not fixable. If we come together as community and as people, I think there is nothing that we cannot fix, especially Broadway's street is an icon street. It's not just Broadway. So why not every year? This is my third year. So we got to keep it going so eventually we can get it bigger and bigger. So the whole, not just Sacramento, the whole Sacramento surrounding from Bay Area, even all the way to, you know, the whole California can come and celebrate with us. Why not?
Yeah, why not? You
yes.
know, the more the merrier.
Yes.
Given that it's now, you're already a couple years in, what are you looking forward to most? Because, I mean, there's music, there's a parade, there's
yes.
wellness, there's food. I mean, there's something for everyone.
Yeah, I think what I'm looking for is really for families, family friendly. Bring your kids. So while your kids are having fun and connecting and you can actually be entertained, food, music. So it's, I'm trying to bring, you know, a whole family, friends. Friends can come and have fun, boyfriend and girlfriend, husband, you know, everyone. It's for everybody. So at the same time, you're supporting the businesses too, small businesses. So it's a feel-good festival that, you know, everybody need to be part of.
What about the parade? That sounds like a lot of fun.
Yes. You know, like I was saying, we tried to do it this year, you know, even though the Broadway, construction was going on. So that was a little bit hard up, but we got to do what we got to do. The city has to do what they have to do. So we're trying to kind of celebrate, give energy through parade, because we need that energy. People, you know, we've been through a lot through COVID, through this and that. So we want to celebrate life. And the parade is from all over walks of life. We want to celebrate that too, just give it that energy so people can feel the music energy, the parade, the drum, and everything that who we are as people and as human beings.
For people who are going to be going for the first time on Saturday, what should they know? You know, when does it start? How long does it run?
So we'll be starting at 10, from 10 to around 7. We got to be done by 7, so we try to shut it down by 6. So because, you know, it's getting dark now. So normally when we're doing Broadway International Festival, we do it in September. So we have time until like 8, 9, still sunny. So right now we're trying to have from 10 to 7. So you can come anytime. You know, the whole day we'll have stuff going on. Every day is like we have packed stuff going on. Like we can't even fit people. Like, sorry, like next year we'll do it like 10 hours. Because we have so much artists. We have so much talent in art and music here in Sacramento. And it's just, I feel sometimes so bad. Like, I wish I can have everybody on the stage and be a vendor. But because of the, you know, the limited time and access we have, we try to fit everybody. But at the same time, we want everybody to come and have fun and enjoy themselves. And it's free, too. So they don't have to pay nothing.
All ages and free.
Yes.
This Saturday.
Yes.
Finally, Zion, before we let you go, I mean, your business is also expanding.
Yes.
Like, talk to us about Sheba's Cafe.
Yes, right there on Broadway. So, you know, as you know, yeah, coffee came from Ethiopia, originated from Ethiopia, and Ethiopia has the best coffee in the world. Most people don't know. But so it is natural for me because I have Ethiopian restaurant and a lot of, you know, people come just for the coffee, too. So I'm partnering with my daughter so we can have a coffee shop down the street on Broadway. It will be 1049 Broadway across the street from Target. So the coffee, I just want to share that coffee culture with Sacramento community as well.
Well, Zion, thank you so much.
Looking forward to it.
I'm looking forward to this weekend, too.
Yes, I can't wait.
Zion Tedessa is the owner of Queen Sheba, Ethiopian restaurant on Broadway, and is one of the lead organizers of the Broadway International Festival. It is free, and it is happening this Saturday.
Yes.
And that is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast. If you want to join the conversation, email us at insight@capradio.org. Thank you to producer Sarit Lashinsky and managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital producer is Chris Hagen. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones, and our engineer is Chris Feltz. Our show music is produced by Adrian Gilmore. And I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. Have a great day. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.